I will tell you what, this was a busy Thursday in the land of business and this economy. We will walk you through it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryznall. It is Thursday, 28 May. Glad as always to have you along with us, everybody. We begin today, no, not with that social media executive order, though we will get there. Also, no, not with this morning's still, after even 2 months of it, maybe more a little bit, that mind-boggling number on unemployment claims, though we will get there too. We begin instead, and try to contain yourselves now, this is riveting, I know, with corporate bonds. And we do so because in the last couple of months, companies have borrowed somewhere north of $1 trillion. And that propensity to borrow, explains Marketplace's Justin Ho, can give us some insights into how corporate America is feeling about things.
The pandemic has hammered a lot of companies' income, so they've been borrowing to give themselves a buffer.
To kind of weather the storm and to make sure that they have funds available to pay suppliers, to pay employees, things like that.
That's Colin Martin, a fixed income strategist with the Schwab Center for Financial Research. He says all kinds of companies have been borrowing, certainly in sectors that are seeing big revenue declines, think retail and travel, but also safer sectors like banking and tech. Martin says investors want to put money into well-known companies.
If you know who they are and they have business models that can continue to proceed, given everything that's going on, you know, that allows them to issue debt.
Apple, Disney, and AT&T are among companies that are borrowing more, even though they already have a lot of cash. Mateo Arena at Marquette University says interest rates are at rock bottom levels. Thinking is,
well, maybe we don't need the cash right now, but if we issue a, let's say, 30-year bond, we lock this low rate for a long time.
But corporate debt isn't cheap for everybody. Chuck Tomes at Manulife Investment Management says hotels, airlines, rental car companies, and casinos are paying more to borrow, given the chance they'll end up defaulting.
But they have to say, okay, we're going to issue it because they're not seeing any cash flow to their underlying businesses, and they need some sort of lifeline.
Hertz Car Rental filed for bankruptcy last week after racking up nearly $19 billion in debt. Tome says companies in those risky sectors were already under pressure before COVID-19.
What this pandemic and shutdown did was it accelerated kind of their fate in a much shorter period of time.
Tome says so far this year, the number of corporate defaults is hitting levels we haven't seen since 2009. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Okay, that executive order President Trump signed today, a move the president claims that will let him regulate Facebook and Twitter and the like. We will not here wade into the details of who did what to whom. We will, however, point out that this is a sticky, sticky economic wicket. Last year, Molly and I, that's Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, on our podcast, Make Me Smart, we talked to the guy who literally wrote the book about the law in question. It is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996. His name is Jeff Kossoff. He teaches cybersecurity law at the Naval Academy. Here's just a minute or so of that interview. As you write, Congress decided to let the platforms have this power, and the platforms have proven themselves not up to the challenge. And the idea that we now have to count on Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey to defend free speech at the same time as they're running a for-profit company that controls information flow to billions of people seems problematical.
Yeah, there definitely are some problems with the model. So, I mean, Section 230 was built on this theory of user empowerment, meaning that users would determine the community standards that they want, and they would walk away from platforms if those platforms were not generally meeting those standards. Now, the big problem with that is you now have these massive companies, and it's hard to walk away from Facebook if you want to connect with your friends, because, or if you want to log on to a service that uses Facebook login, or all of those things. So I think that that's the bigger problem.
That was Jeff Kossoff. He's an assistant professor of cybersecurity law at the United States Naval Academy. The book on the topic at hand is called The 26 Words That Created the Internet. Molly is talking to him tomorrow on Marketplace Tech, by the way. It's a fresh interview to get the latest on this whole thing. You should check that out. I obviously will. Okay, that unemployment number from this morning. Another 2.1 million people filed for benefits in the past week, 40-something million since everything shut down. And 55% of the jobs in this economy that vanished in the past month were jobs lost by women. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more on the labor market coronavirus gender gap.
Think about the job losses right now. Clerks at retailers, restaurant servers, office assistants. This is work done mainly by women. And these jobs aren't all coming back. 42-year-old Adriana Lona lost her position at a nonprofit near Chicago planning live events.
Considering everything that happened, I would have to most likely give up that role, yes.
Industries that mainly employ men, think manufacturing, construction, they haven't lost as many jobs during the coronavirus pandemic. That's the exact opposite of what happened during the 2008 financial crisis. Jasmine Tucker at the National Women's Law Center reminds me that was called the man session.
Construction stopped happening on new homes. We saw a lot of production and manufacturing halting, and that's also a male-dominated job.
Tucker says, according to her research, now we're in a she session, and women could have a harder time getting back into the workforce than men did after the Great Recession, especially women who have kids, like Amy Gergley in upstate New York. She lost her tech job in mid-March and is now the primary caregiver and homeschooler for her 8-year-old son.
And I really don't know how that will pan out when I'm looking for potentially for a full-time job.
Some new jobs are being created right now, says Andrew Challenger of Challenger Gray and Christmas.
The jobs that are being added tend to be on the back end in supply chain and logistics in the warehouses.
But that work is mainly done by men. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this newsy Thursday. Wait, did I mention China and more tensions there? No? Details, numbers, you know the drill. Were these normal times, I'd have just been back a couple of weeks ago from a trip out to Iowa, spending a little quality time in the cab of April Hemis's combine planting corn and soybeans. Reality being what it is, though, I'm here, she's there, so we got her on the phone. Hey, April.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I could complain, but it would do no good whatsoever, so...
Yeah, I hear you. So look, as I said up in the introduction, the plan was for me to be out there while you were planting. Had I been able to be there, I know, right? And I would have driven a tractor and everything. Had I been able to be there, what would I have seen? What would have been the deal?
You would have seen the most beautiful planting conditions I have seen for years, and I mean probably 10 years. We had beautiful dry soils, and everything went in the ground in record pace. It was just gorgeous. So I did think of you. I go, of all the years he had to miss, the one that goes good.
Yeah, but believe me, I'd rather be there than where I am right now. Worried, though, on the back end? I mean, I guess you have to plant what you can plant, but are you not worried on the back end about prices and having a bumper crop and all of that stuff that farmers have to deal with?
Of course, you know, but that's part of it. I mean, you know, farmers are used to dealing with that kind of adversity, and that's just what we do. And, you know, I'm sitting here putting in a crop in the ground that's probably cost me $3.20 a bushel for corn, and my price right now is $3.01. And like you said, probably a record crop we have sitting out there.
So you're going to lose money again on your chosen profession, right?
Yeah, it's really fun. I love farming. No, but it's not. I mean, I had chances last year to sail ahead. Like, for example, I had some corn contracted, and I got the contract sheet. I sold that corn for $4.33 a bushel, and the overrun they sold for $2.88 a bushel. So that's truly what we're looking at.
That's great. And
that's our reality. And so that's why, as much as I hate the government payments coming in, that's what helps us pay the bank back and farm another day.
Yeah, so let's talk about those government payments coming in sort of in the abstract, right? There were the relief payments to farmers from the Trump administration after the trade war and trying to make you guys at least close to whole. Last time we talked, you were doubtful. In fact, the last like three times we've talked, you were doubtful that any of this China phase one trade deal was going to make a difference for you. You still have the same mind?
I really am. I just looked up and I've been on a lot of Zoom calls and meetings and stuff like that, since everything's virtual. And all of the experts are saying they're going to go to Brazil. And I was just reading a Reuters.
The Chinese are going to go to Brazil?
The Chinese are going to keep buying from Brazil, because even though, you know, we may have low prices, their money is so low. The real is so low, it makes their soybeans cheaper. So we really don't have any bright spots in soybeans looking forward.
Yeah. Real quick on the times in which we live, is COVID a factor for you, like in your day to day? I mean, other than wearing a mask to go to that place where we had lunch, I mean, are you dealing with it? What's going on?
You know what? It really isn't. We, as farmers, we socially distance this time of the year anyway. I'm either in a tractor or going to John Deere for parts or going to, you know, the grocery store, and that's about it. I do go to the grocery store for my mom. You know, she's in her 80s, and I'd rather do that for her. Yeah. So, like you said, other than wearing a mask when I go out, that's about it.
All right. Well, look, stay safe whatever you're doing, okay? Will
you? Please? You guys, too. I think of you. Right. I hope you stay safe there.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Maybe I'll eventually get out there again. Thanks, April.
I hope so. See you soon.
Not for the first time, we note on this program that this crisis is laying bare some of the fundamental flaws in this economy, specifically for us in this instant, how the underrepresented are being affected more deeply by it. Here is today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Craig Falcon. I am from the Blackfeet tribe in Browning, Montana. My Blackfeet name is Sabinamuka, which means night gun. I own and operate Night Gun Consulting. It covers consulting in different areas of cultural education. Most of my contracts come from off the reservation. All of my contracts since the country shut down have all been canceled. My business accounts are entering the zero mark. If we have a second wave, I feel my business will totally go under. I'm lucky that I built up a good savings, and I'm pretty self-sufficient living out in the country. We have several jobs around here. We have the hospital. We have the treatment center. We have the forestry department, the wildland fire department. We have a tribal grocery store, a tribal hotel, and a tribal casino. We also have tourism businesses. Unemployment on the reservation stands between, I'd say, over 60% unemployment. And this was before the virus. Now that the virus has shut everything down, our unemployment rate is around 85-90%. The state of Montana opened up phase one in May 15th. But the tribe decided to stay closed, to keep our borders closed until further notice, until we have more scientific information that there is no giant second wave coming. That's because if you look at the Spanish flu hit in one wave, then the second wave was six times greater than the first wave. And Native Americans were four times above the national rate to die of Spanish flu. That's a really scary fact.
That was Craig Falcon. He's on the Blackfeet Reservation in Browning, Montana. Tell us, would you, about your economy, about how things are going? You can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
They wanted to have white wages and black wages written out that way because that's how they operated in the South.
Unemployment insurance, the origin story straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. After being up most of the day, the Dow Industrials closed down 147 points, about a half percent, 25,400 on the nose. The NASDAQ gave back 43 points, about 0.4%, finished at 93.68. The S&P 500 off 6, that's 0.2%, 3,029. The president, by the way, said he's having a press conference tomorrow on China. That's kind of what happened. Twitter down 4.4% today. Oh, no reason. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to do some retail now. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra covers that for us. And she pointed out a couple of things in our editorial meeting this morning. Number one, Victoria's Secret is asking a judge to let it break its lease on its store in Herald Square in Manhattan because, of course, of the virus. Number two, J. Crew has already gotten approval to defer its rent payments. Number three, so too has Pier One. And Mariel's analogy this morning on this whole thing was that the economic pain in retail right now is kind of turning into a game of hot potato. Don't be the last one holding it. Here you go.
Okay, we're going to go all in on this metaphor. Hot potato. You know the game, right? The potato's hot. Nobody wants it. It goes round and round the circle. Basically, overnight, American consumers stopped buying clothes and shoes and lots of other things. And big retail chains do not want to be holding that potato. So they pass it along, for instance, to their landlords. Joel Bynes is a managing director at Alex Partners.
I would call it more throwing the potato as hard as they can at landlords. Essentially, the retailers have said, we're just simply not paying rent and we'll figure it all out later.
Landlords might win legal battles with the retailers eventually and get their rent money, but in the meantime, they have to pay their mortgages. They can try to toss the spud to their banks and see what happens. The next potato, retailers are passing it to their suppliers.
Just extending the analogy way farther than it was designed to be extended, it's more like retailers cutting up the potato and handing pieces of the cut-up hot potato to various suppliers in various amounts.
As for what that looks like in practice, here's Craig Rowley at Korn Ferry.
First and foremost, canceling orders. Second is delaying their payment schedule. So yes, I want the product, but instead of paying you in 30 days or 60 days, I'm going to pay you in 120 days.
And the retailers have a lot of power here, so vendors will try to hang in there and meanwhile pass the tater even further, if possible.
The vendors then go to their suppliers, the people who provide them fabric, materials, and the like, and push back on them to say, again, the same word. We just had orders canceled, so now we're going to cancel your orders.
Finally, there is the debt potato. Yeah, we're still doing this. A lot of retailers have racked up billions of dollars in debt over the past decade. Now they're filing for bankruptcy and getting rid of it. In other words, passing the potato yet again. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
You can love them or you can not, but social media influencers have become a staple of the tech economy over the past decade or so. People who get paid by brands and by companies to post pictures and videos of everything from weight loss tea, whatever that is, to makeup. But that business model, like oh so many others, has taken a hit in the past 90 days. So Instagram has come out with some new features to let those influencers maybe keep on making money. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has that one.
With widespread quarantine orders, people are spending more time online. But there's rampant unemployment and consumer spending has gone down. Marshall Sandman, a social media consultant, says
marketing budgets have completely disappeared. And so it's going to be really, really hard for influencers, creators in the digital space to make a full-time living.
Instagram now says it will make it easier for influencers to have more direct revenue from viewers. For example, by allowing ads on IGTV, an Instagram feature that allows longer videos to be posted. About half of the revenue from those ads will go to the influencers themselves. It's something other social media platforms have been doing for years. And Professor David Craig from USC Annenberg says Instagram is starting to feel the competition.
They're losing to TikTok. So this is definitely a big attempt to try to keep from losing more to TikTok.
But with less consumer spending right now, can the influencer economy survive? Experts say depends on what they're selling. If it's fitness, like Britney Babe, a workout guru with 1.6 million followers on Instagram.
Get ready to build your booty, babes. The Better Booty program consists of quick 10 to 15 minute workouts you can do at home daily.
She'll likely fare better than, say, a travel and leisure influencer, because exercising is something anyone can do. Traveling right now, that's a tough call. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
There was a Washington Post Ipsos poll the other day showing Black and Hispanic workers are more likely to be laid off than whites. They are also less likely to have much in personal savings, which means unemployment benefits become all the more important. Our documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour, has a new season out, the latest episode of which is all about unemployment insurance, the history of it, and who gets it. Here's Chrissy Clark. She's the host of The Uncertain Hour.
Congress passed the law that created our unemployment benefit system in 1935 as part of New Deal legislation. They designed it to give people money to survive while they looked for a new job. But Bill Spriggs, an economics professor at Howard University, says written into that law was this big catch that certain jobs didn't qualify for unemployment benefits, including two key ones.
Agricultural workers and domestic workers.
Agricultural workers, you know, farm workers, and domestic workers, like housekeepers, nannies, which sounds kind of bureaucratic and technical at first, but there's a deeper and uglier backstory. Here's what happened. In order to get any of the New Deal legislation passed into law, including unemployment insurance, there had to be buy-in from politicians across the country, including the Southern Democrats. And they had a very particular world order they were trying to enforce, one of white supremacy.
The signs were obvious, literally. They would have above the water fountain, colored only, white only. And the South did not want that disturbed. And repeatedly throughout every piece of legislation in the New Deal, they tried their best to ensure that system would not be challenged.
At first, in early New Deal legislation, way before we got to unemployment insurance, white Southern Democrats were really explicit about what they wanted to put into the laws. It's in the legislative record. Like in a measure that allowed the president to regulate industries for fair wages.
They wanted to have white wages and black wages.
Like really written out that way.
Written out that way because that's how they operated in the South. That was quickly defeated because the Northern Democrats just weren't going to go for it.
So Northern Democrats in Congress made what's been called a devil's bargain.
The compromise with them was, okay, you can't say this only goes to white people. So the compromise is you can exclude certain occupations. That's okay. And we'll live with that. So we will exclude agricultural workers. We will exclude domestic workers.
And it just so happened that workers with those jobs were disproportionately black, disproportionately women, and poor. So a few years later, when Congress was drafting laws around unemployment insurance, Southern Democrats just said, we want to exclude farm workers and domestic workers. Wink, wink.
That's basically it. So we will say agricultural workers, but in the South, that means we don't want black people to get this. That's what they did.
And just to play out why, historian Alice O'Connor from UC Santa Barbara says excluding those workers from benefits was partly about keeping labor cheap. Like for cotton farmers who needed seasonal workers to come pick their cotton. If those workers got some money when they were not working, that might make those workers a little less desperate and have a little more bargaining power to ask for higher wages the next season.
This kind of protection, it empowers workers. It puts them in at least somewhat less dire circumstances such that they're not necessarily beholden to one local employer.
It took years of pressure from civil rights and labor activists, but domestic workers and agricultural workers did gain access to unemployment insurance in 1976. But for 40 years, those jobs were excluded, jobs that had been disproportionately done by black people. Generations of certain workers didn't get the same safety nets as everyone else, and that had a huge impact on their ability to weather hard times, to build wealth, to climb up the economic ladder. Inequalities that are still playing out today. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
The new season of The Uncertain Hour is called A History of Now, which I kind of love. You can get it wherever you choose to download. This final note on the way out today, you know, you can get economic forecasts pretty much anywhere. Wall Street analysts, the Congressional Budget Office, the Federal Reserve, they are kind of a dime a dozen, those forecasts. One place, though, not updating its prognostications this summer, breaking a streak that goes back to the 1970s, the White House. Nobody likes to be the bearer of bad tidings, I guess. All right, here's your moment of economic context for this Thursday China trade war edition. The New York Fed is out with a study today showing the tariff and counter-tariff narrative that occupied much of us the past 2 years has lowered share prices of the companies in its study by 6%, cost those companies $1.7 trillion in market capitalization. The trade war, by the way, is still going on, lest you forget. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.